Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Smashbox TV's podcast 414.
The 414. That's the Milwaukee area code.
Straight up area code in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where we're coming to you from. I'm Terry Miller, the disc golf guy, alongside Johnny V. Man, back in our day, Johnny, there was only, what, three area codes in all of Wisconsin?
414-920-715.
Nope. Before that.
Oh.
920 got added much later.
That's true.
414 was the southeastern Wisconsin.
The Madison area.
Madison was 608 and 715. That was all of Wisconsin. Three area codes.
Yeah.
A little history you didn't plan on Tuesday night. Here we are. Smashbox 414, though. Who says we're not a disc golf podcast? Tonight,
everybody,
in just a few moments, actually, we're going to be welcoming in our Great Lakes Open champion, Natalie Ryan. And then after we're done speaking with Natalie Ryan, we're going to have the Great Lakes Open tournament director. He's also was recently the tournament director for the Junior and Masters Worlds.
Did he get voted onto the board of directors again?
And no, I don't think so. But and he is going to be the Ledgestone Insurance Open TD, which is our next Disc Golf Pro Tour Elite Series event. Of course, that's coming up right after the Mid-America, which is going to be coming up this weekend, the weekend after the massive, intense week that is Ledgestone. And I'm talking about our PDGA Board of Directors TD super guy, whatever, Nate Heinold.
He literally got 2 write-in votes, I think.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about the election a little bit later, but I appreciate you, the 4 people that wasted a vote.
Wait,
by writing me in.
How many votes came to your house? 3?
okay. Maybe. Yeah, there were 4 write-in votes. I was gonna say, I'm not even flattered. I'm a little saddened that you guys, whoever did that, that you wasted a legitimate vote, and you could have applied it to one of our already eligible candidates. But
if maybe there wasn't somebody that they supported,
that's
they would fill it in.
One way to abstain. Well, someday, I don't know if I can say mark my words, but someday
you'll think about it.
I'll think about maybe possibly running for a position on the board.
I personally am going to claim all the others because people couldn't spell my name.
Yeah.
That's all I'm claiming. Just
that makes sense. Well,
great.
So, again, we'll talk about that later. We got some more info to get out of Nate Heinold. He's got a lot of things going on. But right now, all that matters is we have our champion, our FPO champion from this weekend, joining us for the first time in 9 months. The last time she was here, she was champion of an A-tier. Now she's champion of an Elite Series event. I'm talking about Natalie Ryan. Good evening, Natalie. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We
Fantastic.
Are good. 414 episodes later.
We're getting close. I always love that when you come on, you've got the best headset. Honestly, Built-in headphones, microphone, don't have to worry about any echo cancellation, none of that stuff. You look like you're ready to frag some people in Call of Duty. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, I don't want to miss out on your lovely voices. I mean, yeah. I got to get all of it, you know?
Do the kids still say frag?
Yeah. Are you poning noobs out there? Do kids still say that?
Nope.
No,
I might be. Who knows?
do you do online gaming? I feel like those headsets usually go hand in hand with online gaming.
I do a little, but it's mostly like player versus environment or enemy. It's not really player versus player for me. I don't really get a lot of enjoyment out of that, but I do a little bit of gaming on the side.
Okay. And have you had already off the rails? Have you had that conversation at all with Haley King, who seems to be doing a lot of gaming and then posting about it?
I haven't, but I might have to tonight.
Okay. Yeah, I just know that often when we see her post, and I think that's a legitimate form of her relaxation, is that she does some gaming. She's been posting about it quite a bit. And I keep thinking if somehow, unfortunately, we ever lose her from the tour, I feel like gaming is the place that she would go. So... either way, thank you for joining us. And as I was just alluding to, the last time that we talked to you, I believe was October of 2021, so almost 9 months ago or so, and you had just won Stafford? Does that ring a bell?
Down East Players Cup.
I apologize. Down East Players Cup. I think we talked about Stafford at one point. You had won the Down East Players Cup. There were 14 competitors in the division. And that was... as you said, that was your largest win to date. So
yes.
We talked about van life. We talked about part-time and full-time work. We talked about the tour and you possibly ever taking down some of the best in the world to win an Elite Series event. So from your perspective, kind of fast forward through those 9 months for us. What does that mean to you?
Oh, Lord, I honestly didn't think I'd have ever really done it. I'm kind of at a loss for words when it comes to kind of describing how I've been feeling the last couple of days based on that. But it's just, I don't know. I always knew I could kind of win one of the Elite Series events. I just never thought it would really ever happen. I don't exactly know why. It's just one of those gut feelings I've always had in the entire year so far.
This year has, you know, I think back to the opener of this year, and I remember very vividly when I was out on the sidelines walking around that you had some form of injury and something wasn't right when we were at Las Vegas. And so
yes.
Maybe describe a few of the physical injuries that you've either endured or that may or may not be lingering or nagging for you in general.
So yeah, this year I've had a significant number of injuries that I probably should look at maybe trying to fix a little better with my practice. So at Vegas, I hurt my hamstring. I think it was just a pulled muscle at the time, but it was enough to pull me out of the event. And then not even, I think a month later, I had messed up something in my shoulder. I'm not even really sure what it was, but that dropped me out of, the open at Belton. And so on and so forth. There were a number of injuries that I've had this year that have kept me from really playing my best when it mattered. I don't exactly know why they keep happening though. I think it's mostly just an overwork issue. So I've been kind of trying to lessen the number of practice rounds I've been playing and try and do more rest and recovery rather than, you know, 2-3 rounds a day like I was last year.
More putting practice.
Seems to have been helping more recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a little easier on the body than throwing 350 to 400 feet constantly.
Yeah, and I guess to that point, you know, someone that's been added to the Pro Tour in the last few years, originally was around with Disc Golf Strong, and now he's there very much as an asset to our Pro Tour athletes in a lot of ways, is Seth Muncy. Do you... check in with Seth? Do you do any warm-ups with Seth or cool-downs or anything of that nature? Or do you handle most of your ailments and issues on your own?
So when my initial first couple of injuries happened, I had pretty much exclusively gone to Seth for advice on how to rest, how to recover, how to get back into the game quicker. all of that sort of stuff. And his advice was instrumental in me getting back, you know, so quickly to Waco following Vegas and to, I believe it was, oh, what was after? I had to skip Texas States after Belton, but the tournament following that, I was 100% again, thanks to his advice and his help. But I haven't been going to him as much recently because I kind of have been just using his advice continuously, just been kind of working with what he has told me those times, just continuously forward rather than constantly trying to bother him. So it's been kind of helping.
Well, I just think of Seth and I see him in the warm-up zone and what he's been doing. And there are frequent visitors in there. I see some people in there every single weekend, sometimes before and after the round. And I just think about, you know, the resource that he has become and everything that he and, you know, the Pro Tour provide in that way. And what do I know? But I would encourage you. I mean, I don't think it's bothering him at all. I think I would certainly encourage you to try to take full advantage. I mean, we've come a long way in disc golf to now that we even have a person like him. So the fact that he's there, I think you should certainly utilize him whenever you can. One of the other big things that we talked about a lot of fun stuff, including your parkour, including locksmithing, all sorts of things. But we talked about touring and a van and what that meant, what that might look like, and your plans for it. So tell us where your van and your tour life is in that regard.
So my van is actually very, very good right now. A month ago or so, we were having a little bit of mechanical problems with the engine, but we took some time off just before this previous event. Oh God, I already forgot the name of it. That's not going to be great. Deglo, there we go.
The one you won.
Yeah, the one I won. Yeah, I already
call it Deglo. I mean, it's the Discraft Great Lakes Open, but it's been known, forever as Deglo. Yep.
But just before that, we had actually gone home and gotten the van serviced. So the engine's in better shape than it's been in years, I'm sure. So we're back on the road, you know, less stress, no worries about stopping halfway, getting stuck somewhere. It's been much, much better since we got back on tour this year.
And what did your, we were talking about your van build out, if you had any inspirations, if you saw any other vans, things that you absolutely wanted to have versus maybe things that would be bonuses. We also talked about a budget on that. Do you remember any of those details or where are you at? And I'll help you compare some of the previous thoughts.
We pretty much did exactly what I think we actually mentioned last time. We spent just about as much money as we thought we were going to, and we got exactly the things we thought we were going to need. And we don't regret any of the decisions we did make. Having a very large fridge and a full-size sink in there is huge whenever you're on tour.
Everybody, I feel like, has a slightly different focus. One of the most recent vans that I was in, one of the vans I was in though was Kelvin Heimberg's, and how he prioritized, of course, he's a taller guy, so the size of his bed and some of the things that he found most valuable as opposed to what others prioritize. It's really interesting, and it says a lot, I feel like, about the overall personality. So you said a fridge, and what else did you have in there?
So we have a full-size sink with tap and everything. We have seating, tables, food storage, and a twin size bed. So it's enough for two people to sleep in, but it is a little tight. But we kind of prioritized having a little more leg room since there were going to be two of us sleeping in it year round. So
what would be your advice now that you're this far in with a van specifically, and that there's hundreds of aspiring, if not thousands of aspiring men and women that are out there that are thinking about getting on the tour, they see that van life seems to be the most viable way to do it. What would be your now words of wisdom and advice?
Words of wisdom: only bring what you need and what you absolutely need. There are going to be things that you want, and they're going to sit there and do nothing the whole time you're on tour. We have stuff just stuffed underneath a whole bunch of boxes in the back of our trunk that we haven't touched since we left, and I keep forgetting to get rid of them. But that's the biggest thing. just don't overpack. Travel light, design what you want, and if you don't want it, you probably aren't going to use it. So,
what aren't you using? Like, did
what aren't I using? We brought a poker set that has sat in the bottom of our laundry bin for the entire tour.
Okay. So either online poker is where it's at, or either
just
other
keeping
games
track of it digitally, maybe somehow, or paper.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Do you play cribbage?
I don't. I've never even heard of it, actually.
Oh, geez.
She's not.
Oh,
where did you grow up again?
Virginia.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I know you're from Virginia, but sometimes if you grow up and move there, I wasn't exactly sure. Cribbage is a Midwest game, mostly kind of, you know, that type of heritage. So it's not shocking that you have not played it or heard of it.
Yeah, but you need to, I guess, is where we'll go.
All right.
That.
You know what? I'll look it up.
We'll teach you how to play.
Yes,
sometime.
We will. Johnny and I have dabbled in cribbage tournaments. It gets serious.
It gets serious.
So let's jump into a few specifics for the weekend. And even just looking, we go all the way back to round number one. And you shot a pretty clean round out there. The only bogey that you had was on hole number seven. What comes to mind when you are, you know, now have processed a few days? What comes to mind if when I say round number one at D-Glo? What do you think about?
I think about that bogey and how I wish it wasn't a bogey.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened there?
I struggled to not focus on my mistakes. Well, I miscue off the tee, and then a second miscue immediately after that on the upshot made it very challenging to get up and down at that point. The rest of that's just history.
Yeah. And seven, so, for those that remember, slightly uphill onto an initial kind of plateau. And then generally you're going to have 150 to maybe 200 at most is what you should have for the approach shot onto another kind of hillside or top of a hill. There's danger both left and right. But you got to keep that one clean, right?
Yeah, so the tee shot, I ended up short, low, not even up the hill. So I had no look to get to the pin from my upshot and ended up needing to try and just kind of get up and down for par. And I threw it directly into the hill on the second shot. So I ended the same shot again, almost. And that made it much, much more challenging to get the par rather than the, you know, the bogey. So.
Okay, so that's round one. I mean, of course, you made probably a few other minor mistakes, but the biggest mistake resulting in a bogey in that sense. What are you thinking when I ask you about round number two and your performance during that round?
So round number two, it genuinely felt like I couldn't make a mistake, which is something I've never actually had happen before. And no matter what shot I decided to throw or choose to do, I couldn't miss. There was only, I think, one putt inside the circle that, like, I really notably should have made, and that was because I thought about it a little too much. And as soon as that happened, I backed up, realized I thought about it too much, and then didn't miss any more for the rest of the round. So I don't know. That it's a surreal feeling when you step up to the tee and you choose the line you want and the disc you want, and then it does that exact same thing every single hole.
You know, the common phrasing, as you just described, it feels like everybody says, I was in a flow state. I'm not thinking about anything. And essentially everything is just going right. Is that a way you would describe it? Or is there some other descriptors you'd use for how things were going?
So I probably wouldn't describe it like that. I was making a lot of different choices that I didn't make in round one. And even during practice, I was throwing the tee shots that I'd liked, but I had a lot of different lies from the fairway that I had to think about and make choices on. And those choices were just the correct ones.
Yeah. And I'm looking, you know, looking at your stats.
You had, people say that.
80% scramble during that round, 88% C1X putting. So you literally just missed one putt inside C1X. And you had that mistake on hole 18 of an out of bounds. So overall, yeah, that certainly had to feel good. Do you feel as if, you know, as I'm looking at all three of your scorecards, do you feel as if there's a front or the back that plays easier one than the other on this particular course?
I would say the front nine for sure. The first like five holes. I want to get like all of them. Okay. Yeah. I don't feel like a lot of people can actually say that because most people I think are just trying to par hole one. But I mean, I was attacking that every time. I didn't get it any time, but I was still attacking it.
Well, it's reachable for most of the women.
Yes.
We saw Emily Beach got it all three rounds, I believe. And, granted, she is a power lefty, and it does set up a little bit better and easier for her. Missy Gannon, I believe, got it two out of the three rounds. It's this, I don't want to say surprising, but I feel like watching the what we watched of the FPO cards seemed to have an easier time with it than the MPO. Just a lot of the men were either blowing past it, not turning it over, going right into the woods. I felt like the top two cards for FPO handled that hole better, whether it was because they dialed it back a little bit, or maybe they can go harder at it and not have to worry about going out of bounds. I don't know, but I was very impressed with watching hole one. I had more fun watching the women play that hole than the men.
Yeah, no. I believe that. I think a lot of it comes down to the women choose to lay up a bit more often than the men will. There's more incentive in MPO for them to just run every green, no matter what hole it looks like. And FPO is not quite the same.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Haven't we seen you bust out some shorter lefty putts? Have we seen you with some lefty drives?
Not really off the tee. No.
Okay.
I will occasionally scramble if I'm like off the fairway. I'll use my left hand to forehand, but that's about it.
Okay. Is that a goal? I mean, I think, you know, we saw Eagle in Europe and he's kind of talked about developing that. Is that a goal? Because I feel like hole one is quite arguably the best, you know, setup for a power lefty, as Emily Beach proves. Would that be a goal of yours to have that?
It is. This offseason, I'm going to be trying to develop it a little bit so that I don't have as much reliance on my forehand. I've been hurting myself a little too often with my forehand, and I don't want to anymore. So I'm going to try to do my best to try and learn lefty instead. And, well, fingers crossed it works out, I guess.
Okay. Break down how you, well, we'll get back to that in a minute. I want to talk a little bit about your form, but first let's talk about round number three. Of course, you know, having, I'll say, the pressures of the big X on your back and having the lead. And, you know, when you, to borrow a Philo term, when you've got sharks in the water, when you have Paige Pierce and others that are obviously not only have come from behind, Paige has come from behind from a 6-stroke deficit, I think three times or six times or something like that. It's like some absurd number. She comes back and catches people. So what are your thoughts going into Sunday morning with what, a 4-stroke lead?
Yes. 4-stroke lead. My thoughts were I need to shoot a 4-under or better. And I didn't do that, but I had strokes to spare when I decided I didn't need to do that anymore. I knew that there was going to be someone charging. I just didn't know who it was going to be. Turned out it was Owen. but I knew I would need to be at least under par by a couple or more to keep pace with what everyone else was going to do, either, you know, just behind me or chase card further out. And I did so. I did so very scary, but I did that.
Talk about, you know, when I think of the last round and I think of, you know, whether you call it a match play mentality or a defensive strategy or whatever you want to, however you want to word it, talk about the last couple of holes and if you knew where scores were at, you, your caddy, like what's some of that dialogue as you're trying to close out and how are you battling through it?
So the biggest thing that comes to mind is on hole 14, when I kind of shanked my tee shot up the hill, ended up way right side, and then just blasted all the way across the fairway into the rough on the left and just had to chop myself way to a bogey.
Yeah.
Everyone else luckily didn't birdie that hole that round, because if they had, it would have been very, very scary. But me losing a stroke there, I knew it was within either one or two, I think, at that point. I knew it was close coming through that hole. So going into 15, I knew I needed to play it either very well or hope everyone else messed up. And both actually ended up happening. so that I was had a, I had that comfortable lead going into 16. I think I had 3 or 4 or something like that going into 16. And at that point, I knew I just could par out, and it didn't matter really what I did off the tee or even on the upshots. So I just kind of coasted in at that point.
Yeah, oh. there was a point that we were actually in the control room talking about whether or not Owen Scoggins was a danger from, I think, the second or third card. Because with a few holes to go, we thought, I mean, if you have a rough time on 16, 17, 18, that brings Owen right back into it. So we were on high alert here because lately Owen's been crushing it. So once you got through hole 16 in the control room, we called it. We knew that it wasn't going to happen for Owen, and that was the only chance, because we knew that Emily, unfortunately, with hole 18 being the hole that it is, we basically considered it not a hole. Nobody's birdieing it. This is the first year anyone's ever birdied it.
Yeah. And that was Ella Hansen with a 49 footer.
Yeah, and Paige got it on the final round.
Yeah, correct. I mean, it's just statistically you're assuming that's a par at best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paige got it from circle two as well.
So how does that vary or differ? Let's just play pretend and say you're in fourth place, and you've got a couple holes left to play. Are you having similar conversations with either yourself or your caddy in terms of, hey, here's just where I want to finish, or what do I need to do to hold on to fourth, or is third still obtainable? Are you having any of those kind of conversations, or are you just head down, I'm just trying to birdie out?
I definitely have those conversations. I have my caddy basically look at scores for me, and then I will basically just ask him where I'm at and what can I do to play my best in that moment. And he'll either let me know, hey, just par out, you're fine, or, you know, birdie everything and you'll move up, or something like that. And he won't really put it into numbers, so to speak, so that it doesn't really get in my head. And that is instrumental, huge, huge, honestly, just to help me kind of focus on playing rather than worrying about the scores. That's what kind of happened after hole 14. I'd asked him, you know, what do I need to do? Am I fine? And he said, you know, just play your game. Don't worry about what they're going to do. And that was what happened.
I feel as if, and I've, you know, it always puts a smile on my face when I hear that caddies, like you just said, don't necessarily have to give a number. They can just say, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, or you're fine. Like, they can keep it generic enough. And then that's usually code. Like, hey, just that. Just you're fine. Keep doing what you're doing, and you know, don't stress over anything. And I think that's got to be one of the most satisfying feelings in the world, of like, hey, they're not telling me I need to birdie this, or I don't need to do this,
caddy.
Or
that's what
it is a good caddy. But I think just as a player, man, that affirmation has to feel incredible.
It does. Hearing that, knowing there were only 3 holes to go, I pretty much at that moment knew I kind of had it, which was a massive relief off of my shoulders at that point, because I was up until 14, I was very, very stressed out. And I think that kind of was noticeable through that back nine. I made quite a few too many mistakes in that early half of the back nine, and then kind of cleaned it up a little bit near the end. But yeah.
Now, I often see, doesn't matter the division, I see bopping along to music, I see big, deep breaths, I see people walking away from crowds and galleries. I feel like I've seen most of the coping mechanisms for someone to calm themselves, to get centered, or to get ramped up, or whatever it is when they're in these high-pressure situations. What do you feel like is your go-to? What gets you calmed down, if anything?
I don't know if I really have a strategy to do that. I think mostly it's just my routine. You know, after I throw basically every shot, I walk back to my bag, I get a sip of kind of like Gatorade, Body Armor, one of those kind of things, and then I will drink some water right after it and maybe have a snack. And it's enough of a distraction to keep me away from being stressed about playing. So that's kind of how I've always kind of strategized with that. I never really came up with like a let's go with the music kind of thing.
Sure. Well, I feel like there's as most of our players will say to some degree, there's a calming security in your routine. And maybe that's why routines are just that. They're so crucial and critical because they're that one place where everybody can reset themselves. And then if they go through their routine, they're trusting their instincts, they're, you know, going through the process, whatever phrasing you want to use, it feels like that's kind of something that always brings them back to it, is just go through the routine. Now, you know, jumping into your success and then you saying, especially in the post-run interview, you've been working hard, and you said it, you know, you said it 9 months ago when we had you and we got to know you a little bit more. You said that you feel as if you're working as hard or harder than anyone else out there in terms of hitting the practice fields, in terms of practice putting and doing those things. Do you still have that drive? And if so, what does that look like for you? What does that commitment look like?
I definitely still have that drive. So I have a schedule in my phone that basically is wake up, eat breakfast, go practice. When you're done with that, eat lunch, field work, putting, all that, go to the gym, work out, shower, and then go to bed, repeat until the tournament starts. I don't feel like anyone else really has that. Not in that capacity. Like they might have a, you know, let's wake up, let's figure out kind of what to do for breakfast, go to the course maybe at this time, I don't know, we'll play with this person, and then we'll go home, and that'll be it. Most people I don't feel like actually finish their round and then work on the shots that they didn't do well that day, and then, you know, practice the putts they didn't do well that day, and that's something I kind of try to focus on.
Where does that commitment and dedication come from? Where how do you maintain the regimen and that kind of focus?
So it mostly stems from knowing that there are people in this sport that have been playing it for five times the amount of time that I have played it, and it's out of a sense of needing to catch up.
Who do you have to catch up to? I mean, I know that sounds silly, but who are you looking at when you're talking about playing catch up? Who do you feel like you need to catch up to?
It's different people for different things. I feel like Paige has better touch than I do. I feel like Owen definitely putts better than I do. You know, it's across the board. There's different people that are better at different things, and I want to catch up to all of them.
You also said in the post-run interview that Paige outdrives you. You of course have talked about having power and then some accuracy to go along with it as we look at this last course. But do you have a ceiling? Do you have a limit as to where you feel like your distance can get to? And is, you know, do you ever think about like what Jen Allen has done and you know, with her 558 foot throw or record throw? Do you have any of those aspirations?
I do and I don't. My main focus right now is on disc golf, you know, competition. I'm not so much focused on just throwing really, really far. That's never really been my focus. That's not entirely true. It kind of was my focus when I just started playing. But when I realized that wasn't the whole game, I stopped kind of focusing on it.
I think that's every new player's thing. Like when you start, everybody wants to...
You want to throw it far.
Everyone wants to throw far. Like, that's the coolest thing. Cool. It's the coolest thing when a disc comes out of your hands and it goes 400 feet. Or you're like, holy, I just broke 400. Or you're posting on it social media, your U-disc tracking and all that stuff. Everybody wants to throw far when they start.
But after I kind of moved on from trying to throw far, I realized that the distance that I have now is enough. I don't need to try and throw farther, and I don't really intend on trying to do so. Could I maybe get another like 50 feet? Maybe, but I'm not going to try and find out because I don't think I need it.
Okay. So then I guess I'll follow that up with, what do you need? You know, if you feel like you're, for lack of a better phrasing, we'll just say your distance is currently adequate. What do you feel like is, you know, I know you just said Paige has maybe better touch than you and owns a better putter. Are those the next, you know, kind of areas of focus for you?
Yes, for sure. I want better accuracy across the board. I may be able to drive it really far, but if it's not an open field, I miss a lot. And that's a struggle that I have, and I'm going to try and fix it as best I can.
Now, and I certainly don't want to harp on it because I don't think anybody loves it, but, you know, you talked with us a little bit about how a few weeks ago you weren't in a good mind frame and in a good mental space as you were competing back at the Idlewild Open. What are some of the best ways that either you, well, what's the best way that you combat that? And then do you have advice for others? Do you feel like other people maybe ignore that and try and fight through it in a different way? What's your take on that? Knowing everyone's a little different, of course.
So I just step away from things. That's the best way that I handle, you know, being anxious or being depressed. I need to, you know, take a few steps back, find, you know, something that can relax me or remove me from the situation that is causing it. And a lot of the time, disc golf is part of the reason that that's happening to me. As sad as that is, you know, you hear all these stories that disc golf's the one thing that saved them from that. And, you know, being outside and exercising and that, you know, it's usually very, very helpful for it. But it's different in my case because of all of the, you know, the hate and vitriol and all this other nonsense I see online and get sent every day. So taking a step away from that for me is the only thing that really helps at the moment. So that's what I did when I went home after Idlewild. I went home. I didn't talk about disc golf for like a week. We didn't really play for like a week. And then I got back into it slowly and here we are.
I almost hate to even ask this, but is there a chance that the disc golf community could chase you out? Like for the reasons you just explained, do you feel like that? Yeah, that could even ever happen.
No, they might make me, you know, sit down, take a minute for myself here and there, but they're never going to make me quit this sport. This sport's so fun. I mean, throwing a disc as far as you can and watching it shape a line, there's nothing beats that.
One of the criticisms that I saw was that it felt as almost if you or anyone for that matter at all removes themselves from a tournament, that it could mess with the flow or the vibe, whether it's that individual card or it's the overall tournament round for that day because of withdrawal. Does that concern you at all? I mean, does a concern of that nature hit you at all?
No, not so much. Because in those moments when I, you know, when anybody needs to drop out of an event like that for that reason, it shouldn't be a worry in your mind. Like you need to do what you need to do to be healthy, and worrying about what everyone else is doing or anything like that that's on them.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. I always feel like we always know what's best for ourselves and whatever that might be. And somebody else doesn't need to understand that. It might impact or negatively in some capacity affect someone else. But at the end of the day, like you have to look out for number one, whatever that is. And if that means you have to withdraw mm-hmm. yourself from a tournament or remove yourself from a situation, I very much can understand that. And I think exactly as you said, you have to do what's the best possible solution for you. The rest of the season is, you know, we're roughly two thirds of the way through the season. How excited are you? I mean, when I think about like the
Ledgestone Worlds,
yeah, not MVP, just the events, but EMC. You know, how much of a boost does an event like this last one and the win give you? How much are you looking forward to the next swing here or the next handful of events?
I have been looking forward to it since we started because they are the events I played last year. And I feel like I have a little bit more, you know, knowledge of the courses. So I don't need to practice as much, which will be massive because then I can actually, you know, focus on, you know, rest, recovery, all that other stuff I talked about earlier. But I also know that, you know, GMC is probably my favorite event of the year by far. Those courses are just gorgeous. And there's no place just quite like that. And I don't know. World's coming up soon. It's the anxiousness is getting up there a little bit, but it's going to be a great finish to the year, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when you start thinking about the, you know, the East Coast swing, the golf that gets played out there, we have a little bit of openness, we have a lot of woods, we have slightly cooler temperatures. I feel like, you know, it's just entirely part of the overall season, and it's like we shift into it just a whole nother dimension of the season we push forward.
Everybody knows fall golf is the best golf.
Yeah, I mean, you're just silly if you think otherwise.
I mean, spring golf is too wet. Yep. Summer golf is too hot. Fall golf is the best golf.
Yes. That makes perfect
temperature,
sense.
Like, gorgeous trees everywhere. What more do you need?
That's what I'm saying.
How do you like your chances in terms of future events? I mean, you've now, you know, you said it in the interview that you feel like you belong. And how do you like your chances as you stack up against other events and we'll say other course challenges?
I like them a lot, honestly. After this weekend, seeing the, you know, positivity, actually, that I was a little surprised about it. It vastly outweighed the negativity that I usually see whenever I do something well. And to notice that for once, it kind of fills me with a little more confidence than I expected. So going forward, I'm planning on, you know, full steam ahead. Let's try to do my best in every event instead of, you know, worrying about what everyone else thinks is going to happen.
When you talk about that positivity and feeling some of that, you know, we'll say love, is that on site? Is that online? Is that, you know, where does that come from? How are you embracing that and where's it coming from?
So as much as I probably shouldn't, I look at just about every comment that everyone posts. Pretty much across the board online, you know.
Why? What? No, I mean, this is another perfect use for a caddy, right? Like, you don't have to look at scores, you don't have to look at comments. Like, just hand the phone to him and be there. You go.
I won't look during the round, and I won't look during the tournament. But as soon as the tournament's over, I'll look. And I was pleasantly surprised this time to actually see that, you know, people were standing up for me without any you know. Incentive to do so, and it was honestly really, really nice to see. But, like, you know, even just 9 months ago, you know, after winning that eight here, there was a lot worse of a reaction for just that, and seeing the positivity come out from winning D-Glo this year is massive.
I'll be the first to admit I'm almost to a copy and paste version of this.
Like a response.
In terms of a response, and I feel like I kind of very loudly blurted this out a few weeks ago, and I'll say it in a slightly more polite version this week. And please correct me if you disagree with it, but there continues to be a conversation about the policy which you fully abide by, and you play under the rules that are set forth in front of you. And we'll talk more about this, you know, probably with Nate in terms of, you know, policies and subcommittees and everything. But the point is, there's a policy that's in place. And if people want to have a civil discussion, yourself included, want to have a civil discussion about the policy, I think that's 100% viable, as it is going on in almost all sports. My problem is when people want to make it about the person and they want to make it about you personally. And they want to tear you down and they want to, you know, call names and do all the terrible things that you already know are happening to you. Policy over the person is what I keep saying. And I guess what I want to ask you is, do you feel that's a fair way to word it? Is that a conversation, or how would you reply if you saw me posting that and said, you know, where I say, we can maybe talk about policies, but let's quit bullying and destroying the person, you or any of our other trans athletes. How would you respond to that? And be blunt with me, please, too.
Oh, I think what you've just said, that is the perfect way to respond to that. Because a lot of the time, they don't actually care about the policy. They just don't want me to play. And they do so in a way, they comment in a way that makes it sound like they're worried about the policy. But in reality, they're just being hateful. So making it about the policy to them, you know, when they follow up with that follow-up reply to your comment, when you're talking about just make it about policy, they'll still mention, you know, me and me being a cheater or something like that. And then it's very clear to anyone, any outside onlooker that sees that conversation, that the person that's talking about, you know, me in general is just an idiot.
they want to make it so personal. And
yeah,
what I wish just people could understand that there's a separation. And somebody said it earlier today to me that you happen to right now, you're the, especially after winning, you're the face of this conversation. And you've been very bold and very brutally honest and upfront with us, and I'm sure with plenty of other people.
Nova thanks you, by the way.
Yeah.
She's on the board. She's like, it was a few weeks ago. I was getting it. Now it's Natalie.
Yeah.
So and, it's passed on.
And at maybe even an increased level because of the Elite Series. Congratulations, Nova, to your play as well. But
Nova won a world championship.
I know. That's what I'm saying. But my point is, it's just disheartening to see that they can't separate and that you're not a villain, or to quote you, you said, you know, you don't want people to see you as a monster. And
right.
I guess my question, if I can find one here, would be when people do challenge you with saying it's either an advantage or any of the other hundreds of, you know, versions of comments that you see, do you have a stock response? Do you have anything pointed or specific you'd like to address everybody with on this platform?
So the biggest thing that I like to kind of harp back to is that, you know, I mentioned this in the, you know, the post-round interview after winning, that I don't do anything in this sport better than everyone else in it. I'm good at a couple of things, but I am not the best at any one thing. I throw far, but there are people that throw farther. I can putt well, but there are people that putt better. Like, when it comes down to it, I'm not, you know, incredibly good like they think I am. I'm not, you know, I don't have an advantage. They seem to think I have something that makes it easier for me to do all these things. But I can promise you, when I throw 430 feet, I am putting every ounce of my being into that disc. And I'm sure there are many other people out there that do just the same thing.
Yeah, and I've said this now for a few days. I feel like a lot of people, you know, traded in their online degrees that they got during COVID to now become psychologists and biologists. So we can all spew all the same words about, you know, puberty and fast twitch muscles and hip structure and bone structure and all of those things. And I'm not dismissing them, clearly. Those are all parts of this overall conversation, and I'm not saying they're not. But those are the things that people immediately go to and then say that that's where your advantage comes from. And you're saying that you don't feel that's the case, especially with the therapy and everything else that you've gone through. Is that what you're telling us?
I don't feel that way. Okay. They may give me small advantages. I don't know, because I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to pretend here that I know better than, you know, people doing research. If someone wants to do that research and tell me that that's the case, sure, you know, by all means, I'll listen. But in the same vein, like, I'm not incredible in this sport at every single thing like MPO players are. Like, hormones have, in fact, made me considerably weaker just overall. They've made me a little bit shorter. Like, there are small things that happen to the body that hormones affect that people don't understand that they can affect. Like, I dropped two shoe sizes, you know, like there are crazy wild things that hormones mess with. And people just think that, oh, well, it's just removing the testosterone. That's the only thing that does. And that's just not true.
Now, nothing more than just genuine speculation, because we've talked about and we've heard all sorts of different solutions. And I feel like there's three main solutions that have been thrown out there. You know, one, everything stays as it is. Two, there becomes a transgender division that's exclusive for transgender athletes. Or three, you play in the MPO division. I feel like those are the three, as far as I know of, those are the three main things that are suggested or thrown out there. Do you feel strongly about any or all of those solutions? How do you view those when you see those or have those constantly thrown out there?
So those second two, basically, are the ones that I have issues with. Go figure. But a trans division isn't really something that is a solution. It's kind of like it's segregation at its core. It's removing us from either division because you don't feel like dealing with us. And then we have a division of two and no one watches it because there's a division of two. And then the us playing MPO, like, no one will sign up because we aren't competitive in MPO because we are literally taking, you know, performance reducing, you know, drugs basically at this point. So we can't be competitive in MPO. So why would we play MPO?
Okay.
It's another way to remove us from, you know, visibility, which is mostly all they really want.
I guarantee you, if there were a separate division, a separate trans division, and it started to get funding, you would hear these same people complain that they're taking money away from other divisions. You can already see, because this same discussion was had about FPO when the money started flowing to FPO to help promote the FPO mm-hmm. field. There were a ton of people that were screaming that it's not fair. MPO has more players. MPO is getting the spotlight. They should be getting more money.
Right.
So the minute we start taking resources and whatever and directing it towards a trans division, we're going to have all these same arguments all over again. I don't see that as a viable solution right now.
Yeah. Like there just isn't a solution that's the best for everybody. No one's like not everybody's opinion is going to be satisfied with whatever result happens. Mm-hmm. My take on that is, why would we exclude people based on a few?
Yeah, and I think that becomes the one of the major points of conversation here is, you know, other words that often are utilized within this entire conversation and sometimes very much within. With it, good intentions, people talk about inclusivity, also talking about fairness. And then I feel like from there, we can always have an argument about what's fair. I mean, your version of fair versus Johnny's versus mine versus, you know, Johnny's wife and his kid here in his house. Everybody could define fair slightly differently. And I think that makes it just a slippery slope in itself. I'm going to say this for the 100th time as well. I don't feel like I have a perfect solution. I certainly don't. I don't have any degrees. I don't have any research. I don't have any background in this. I may have feelings just like everybody else does, but at the end of the day, for me, it comes down to a subcommittee that is going to take in now more research as talked about today and mm-hmm. our elected officials and our subcommittee and the people that are doing this for a living are going to be the ones that are kind of going to not only update the policy or maybe not even update, but just reiterate whatever the policy is and if there's changes that go along with that. So I guess the follow-up to all of that is, no matter what a policy says as early as 2023, maybe it's a dumb question, but are you good with standing by however the policy gets released, whatever it says? I have nobody has any idea what it's going to say because it's only being drafted. Or if there's even going to be a new policy. Let's say there is. Is there anything that you would, I don't want to say vehemently against because obviously there are. What would be the worst case scenario? Maybe that's the best way to put it. What would be the worst case scenario if a new policy comes in and is enacted in 2023, for you personally, what do you feel like is worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario is I'm not allowed to play FPO. If that comes to fruition, I would probably just stop playing the game.
Okay. I mean, they're drafting. I know nothing about any of the scenario. And I don't know where it's going, but all I know is, especially after seeing a post today, both the PDGA and the Pro Tour have basically said there's a committee on it. It was assembled months ago. They're gathering research now. And if there's a policy update, it wouldn't be enacted until the beginning or until 2023. So maybe the follow-up to that is, maybe it would never even happen, but have you had any conversations with the committee? In any subcommittee,
I've taken a survey for them. It was fully anonymous, but I have taken it. I'm not going to share any of my responses clearly, but yeah, they sent a survey out for, you know, just general trans people across the board, you mm-hmm. know, just wanted to see what our feelings were on, you know, how fair the current system was and so forth. And I, you know, I filled it out as honestly as I could, send it off. And I'm hoping that that helps as much as I feel like it would. But I don't know. I don't know how they're going to vote or how they're going to recommend it or any of that. I hope it's in, you know, in the side of inclusivity. That's all.
Okay. Is there, you know, we'll start to wrap up. It's already been an hour, which feels like time flies here.
I told you. When we did our little pre-check, Terry's like, we'll chat for a half hour. And I laughed. And I said, she's been on Smashbox. She understands.
I just know we have a busy night. is there anything, and it clearly does not have to be anything, you know, transgender related, just anything in general that you'd like to share with the world? Anything, you know, whether it's setting anything straight or just sharing with the world that may or may not be even disc golf related. Anything you want to share with us?
Well, I kind of just want to say that sports aren't fair. So all the people that are out there trying to pretend like sports are, you know, inherently super fair, people are born with natural advantages over other people. Just even within the women's division, just, you know, cis women have other advantages over cis women. Everyone has something in their corner that they can rely on when it comes to competition or throwing or any sort of mechanical sort of stuff like that. They try to harp on me for, you know, some advantage they think I have that they can't prove I have. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if I have something or not, as long as it is within the realm of competition for the FPO division, it should not matter. That's kind of my stance on that. I just wanted to
No, I appreciate that. And maybe just to drill down an ounce further on that, by some advantages, you could talk about somebody being of a certain frame size, someone being taller, someone having bigger hands, smaller hands, like all of those different, are those some of the things that you might be referencing?
Yes, exactly.
For example?
I mean, the biodiversity within, you know, the subset of women is, and then the biodiversity of the subset of men, you know, those two things overlap a lot. Those two regions, they overlap a lot. Like the best man, sure, is going to be better than, you know, the best woman. But, you know, the middle road, you know, MPO player or something like that is, or not MPO, but the middle of the road, like subset of men is not going to be better than the best woman. Like that's how these things are. The you know, like overall biodiversity of humans just in general has a ton of overlap between the genders, and people seem to think that they are much farther apart than they are.
Do you think there's a chance, and we're getting off in La La Land here, that regardless of what the PDGA says, the DGPT does something different? Because I
don't know enough, really.
Yeah, I could see a world where the PDGA says this is the policy, and the DGPT says, cool, we're the top elite level of players, and we feel that, you know, trans athletes can compete. Maybe it's different for B tiers or C tiers or A tiers. I don't know what the right answer is, and I don't know. Trust me, being a small part of the DGPT as we are, we don't have any of those answers. I would just be curious as if that's even a possibility. And I was actually kind of directing that at Terry and not you so much, because I know Terry would probably have maybe a slightly more insight into that. And
yeah, I don't know. And I'll just quickly maybe say it to both of you. There have been those calls. There have been, you know, somebody's even on the board right now saying, well, you know, the DGP is going to pull away from the approach or from the PDGA, and they're going to be separate entities and therefore going to have entirely separate rules. Right. I personally don't see that happening. It took a lot of years.
Not anytime soon.
Okay,
I don't see it in the next 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, I mean, I just they worked hard to coexist and to become synonymous, and the pro tour to become the professional tour of the disco of the PDGA. Like, I don't know, but that's a lot of what ifs, you know. And one of the best lines I heard today, and I feel like this is very applicable to a lot of straw man arguments and a lot of things you probably read online as well, Natalie, is instead of talking about what ifs, let's talk about what is. And I just thought that was a really powerful statement. It was coincidentally by an FPO player that I talked to earlier today. And to me, it was a really powerful statement because there's a lot of people that can say a lot of what ifs and make a lot of straw man and just outlandish, unrealistic what if scenarios. And I just feel like that's not dealing in reality. And those are dealing with extremes rather than dealing with where we are right now. But that's how I feel.
I want to end this on a slightly more upbeat note, maybe, and maybe more light. Even though this might be an awkward question, Natalie, how many of those Neptune shirts do you have?
38.
You wear the same shirt every day, and I'm praying that this isn't awkward, that you're going to say one, and everyone's going to be grossed out. So please tell me, how many of those shirts do you have?
I have like 6 of them.
Okay.
I just wear the same one every day because I love it. But I will have more coming soon, some new stuff.
That's perfect. And
that's the answer I wanted to hear. I didn't want to hear anything less than 3.
All right. No, I do want to, that perfectly segues because I knew what the answer was. I want to segue into just describe the meaning to the shirt. You just said it's your favorite. Describe the meaning and how people can pick up their own and support you. So give us the backstory there, please.
So that's the first piece of professional athletic wear that I've ever had made for me. So it's always going to have something kind of special to me. It's got the trans flag stripes across it. And not a lot of people seem to know that, but that is the trans flag, striped across it. In the shape of an N, which, on that, and it's got my logo on it, which is the first logo I've ever had. So it's a special one for me for sure. I'm going to be wearing it forever, I'm sure. If you'd like to pick one up, you can head over to VII.com. They are VIIApparelCompany.com, I believe is actually what it is. They should have it in their shop.
All right. And I do appreciate that because I think a lot of people have gotten hung up on seeing you wear it and not ever thought about the much deeper meanings, plural, as you just described. And I love the idea, and I've seen other people have picked it up and wear it and support you. So we very much want to get that plug in there, that if people want to continue to do so, that they can head over there. Johnny V's even got it up on screen here for everybody. There is the shirt, the Natalie Ryan jersey. And you can pick one up as well. So, or pick up 3 right away, or pick up 6 right away, whatever the case might be. Isn't it funny?
Would I fit into an XL, or do I need to go 2?
Isn't it funny what,
shut up, Miller.
Like, of all the things, what our disc golf fan base concerns themselves with? Do you ever?
A little bit, yeah.
I'll just leave it there. I don't even want you to answer that because I know the answer. Natalie, we thank you. We thank you for, not only your incredible play, but your honesty, your perspectives, and you being an open book. And then maybe more importantly to everyone else out there that you provide an inspiration to. I say it all the time, and I'll say it to you again. I can't imagine what you go through on a daily basis. I've been really worked up thinking about scenarios and situations just these last 2 days. And I then reminded myself, that's a millionth of what you deal with. And I'm just a random guy here. And I do wish you the best in that. Just keep being yourself and inspiring so many people. We all know it. We've all got our haters, no matter what you do. But
Terry told me somebody called me Antifa on a board.
Yeah.
That John is your co-host, who's basically Antifa. And I was like, wow, I didn't know.
Yeah. So, Natalie, congratulations. Thank you for being the spirit that you are. And we're looking forward to the rest of the season from you. And as always, win, lose, or draw, you're always welcome here on Smashbox. We appreciate you. And have a good night.
Same to you. Really appreciate you guys letting me come on here and having this conversation again. It's been a pleasure. Always will be.
Thank you.
Always.
Have a good night.
If we're lucky, it's the last time we have to have it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah.
All right.
Have a good night, Natalie.
Thank you. Good night. All right, guys. Natalie Ryan, congratulations again to her. If I'll just say it, and I
banned a few people tonight.
That's fine. I appreciate anyone that can have a civil conversation, and I just wish we had more of them. And we can agree or disagree. I think this applies to so many facets of life. This isn't just about gender, and it can be applied to literally hundreds of other subjects. But I think starting with a little bit of humility and a little bit of civil discourse is always a good place. And when you open up with an unoriginal meme that's been posted 349,000 other times, not only are you just that, you're unoriginal, but it's an impossible way to have a civil conversation at that point. And I get it. Everyone's going to agree or disagree. And I'm right here to listen to, again, civil discourse and have those serious conversations, but let's be humane about it. And yeah, that's not just for Natalie. I think that's for everybody. So we appreciate all of you who could find a way to still keep it on the up and up here.
I almost banned Dan Mao because he said that all disc golf in Minnesota is better than Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's a bannable offense as well.
I was so close, dude. So close.
That is definitely. So I'm going to take 2 seconds here. Johnny, you got other... Why don't you hit on some MPO stuff while I give you guys...
Well, real quick,
I get set up with Nate Heinold after you finish off on the FPO stuff.
Leah, let's talk about FPO real quick. Obviously, Natalie having a great weekend and winning, shooting 18 under par. Own Scoggins, who, whether she likes it or not, I'm going to mention it, qualifies for FP40, is our FP40 world champion. Takes tied for second with Emily Beach. Emily Beach playing some really good golf, power lefty. Just fun to watch off the tee. Obviously, Owen probably getting it done on the green. I actually haven't even looked at her stats, but out there, it feels like she's keeping it inbounds and she's sinking putts from everywhere, is my imagination. Fourth place, a tie between Paige Pierce and Valerie Mondejano. Sixth place was Sarah Hokum, which for a crusher course like this, I feel is a really good finish for Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, I'm looking over at her lack of bogeys and sprinkles in a bunch of pars. Yeah, some solid work.
Yeah, she's not usually a fan of these bigger, longer courses, but obviously Sarah shooting very, very well. Macy Vela-Diaz, another big arm out there. She's, you know, and a decent putter as well. It's fun to see her kind of starting to get into her own. Tied with Katrina Allen in sixth, as well as obviously Sarah Hokum. Ninth place, Kat Murch. 10th place, Holland Hanley, another crusher. So you can kind of see maybe a small thread of this being favorable to some longer arms. So congratulations to all the women who competed. That's a grueling course. Trust me. It's
For the guy who has never walked it.
I've walked toboggan. Not that,
yeah. Sorry.
Not that particular.
In 2000, you played a few holes there.
Yeah, I played an entire two rounds.
I think they cut you.
Well, maybe it was only one round and I got cut. I don't remember. I didn't bother to look. But yes, that looks like a grueling course.
Yes, there you go. That's better.
Let's go.
You did not walk 109 holes of it.
No,
like
God,
I did.
No, I did not.
And to be fair,
and you don't look like you did either.
To be fair, I didn't fully walk 109 holes. Our cameramen did. I took
That's
a shortcut.
True.
They, I took a shortcut here and there.
I think the cameramen only like they got to cut out two or three holes.
That's true. They did the Smashbox shuffle.
They did the Smashbox shuffle. So on hole one and two, where you go down and then back up, they would reverse. And so they're basically just getting a vacation practically.
I had what 61 holes of golf there in June with the Amnats and 109 holes of golf there this last weekend. I've had enough of the toboggan. We'll see you next year is what I'm trying to say.
I don't think anyone is sad to leave that course. Like it's a great course and people seem to like it, but I think by the end of the weekend, you're not sad to drive away.
I was trying to, you know, it is a valid question. If there's any more consistent elevation and challenge on the tour, and I don't think there is.
Philo had even mentioned that he feels that that is one of, if not the most grueling course that the DGPT plays.
I don't know.
Up and down constantly. There's
170 holes there, and I'm still overweight. Slightly. I don't know.
So you're saying, all right, you're saying I should get the 2XL Natalie
cover,
jersey.
Let's chat on the men's side, then we'll bring in our TD.
Let's go over to MPO real quick. Calvin Heimberg, coming back from Europe and, you know, winning in, it took him an extra hole, but that's Calvin's style lately.
Yep.
One extra hole. Don't get into a playoff with Calvin is the motto now. Second place, Corey Ellis, unfortunately, what, a quarter of an inch that he was out of bounds?
I didn't look at it, but that's what he had said, so I'll believe him.
It honestly almost looked as if, and I did hear that it hit the boards and bounced back,
yep.
But it almost looked as if when it bounced back, it pushed grass and even maybe moved the line just a hair. Enough where you it's out. The line is clearly visible on one side.
Okay. Yeah.
But it was that close. It was that close. And ultimately, Corey not able to get it done in extra holes like Calvin did. So second place. Third place is Ricky Wysocki, shooting a 10 down to jump up, just like Gavin Rathbun in fourth place. He shot a 10 down as well. Tied for fourth was Adam Hammes. Sixth place, Kyle Klein, always the bridesmaid. That guy was very, very close again this year. Andrew Marweed, as I said, coming into his style of courses, this is his time of year. Don't sleep on Marweed. I think he's going to kind of, you're going to see him finishing up in those top 10 places much more frequently now coming up. Paul McBeth shooting an unstellar final round to drop down to seventh. He was in contention for the first few holes, but then unfortunately just couldn't get anything going. Brody Smith. Talk about, as they, you know, I think the Ultra World calls it, horses for courses. Big crusher course, Brody has it. And played very well, putted pretty decent. Ultimately, was able to get to ninth place. Congratulations, Brody. Simon rounds out the top 10. It appeared that final round, Simon was going for a few more Simon lines.
You know, yeah, at a certain point,
when he got about halfway through that course, I kind of felt like I heard someone say, Simon's just throwing now, and it was just he knew he wasn't winning and he wanted to take some bigger lines. So, you know, that's life. So,
well, I noticed that as well. Hole 15, for instance, very much a Simon line, and him getting and that's fine.
Did somebody ask? Is that fair?
Like that he can just give up and then start throwing ridiculous lines
into the OB where people have to sit and it slows everything down. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, you
can't.
He can't
penalize somebody for that.
No, he is not. You know, six putting on the final hole to then have it get outside of his standard deviation for his rating. That. He's not doing something nefarious of that line. He's just taking. I mean, could you say the same thing when somebody keeps going for a tin cup scenario when they could move forward?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before Nate Heinold here is
in our Disc Baron Digital Green Room.
And I need to read. I missed a letter in his name. Oh, wait, did I? Is that how you spell it?
I don't know. Sure.
Yeah, I feel like that looks wrong. But I have to ask the burning question. What was the disc you found? When Paige Pierce yelled, Terry, find my disc, you went in but came out with a different disc. What was the disc and what did you do with it?
I kept it. No, you... hey, my favorite jack wagons. Thanks for getting me fired up. There's some jack wagons that don't know what they're talking about. I will, but took that clip.
Nate.
Yeah, sorry. They took that clip and then said, oh, he doesn't have any integrity. That's just like him. F you, Save Women's Golf or whatever your ridiculous. Oh, you guys are so disgusting. Anyway, it was a joke. I turned it in. It was an ESP Force with no name on it. So I got hit up earlier today about it. Somebody had asked if it was a different Zeus or a Big Z Zeus. It was an ESP Force with no name. And I jokingly said, oh, there's no name. This is going in my collection. Which the commentator said, Terry wouldn't bother, which I wouldn't. Of course I wouldn't. I don't care. I don't need another ESP Force. But when you're... as bright as some of the other people that we deal with, and they want to snip the clip, and then they want to go out there and say, oh, he's got no integrity.
I didn't know what it was, but
you guys talk about integrity. Get a clue.
I'd even said, I'm like, first of all, If it somehow made it to Terry's car, it would probably never come out because it would be there for months. But there's no reason. Terry, I said, Terry probably just dropped it off the
lot. And even if I did keep it, technically, it's got no name and it was left and abandoned on a course. I wouldn't, and I don't need it, but I didn't. But even then, one would argue, well, no name, no number.
It shouldn't, seems like a disc you could keep. And it shouldn't have been then. It should not have been thrown on during the tournament.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't there because every disc needs to be marked.
I didn't keep it.
No, you didn't. All right, let's get Nate.
Fine.
On here before you go off any further. We need to stop him, Nate. We need to stop him. So without any further ado, we're bringing on our board of directors. What's he considered? The president of the board of directors?
I'm not giving him any extra titles.
I don't know.
He runs some tournaments.
He runs two tournaments. You know, a lot of them have a lot of payout, and he travels, and he's got this big thing. And Nate Heinold, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, buddy.
You're muted, Nate. We don't hear you.
We don't hear you for some reason. This is our best interview ever with Nate.
Everybody's cheering. I don't know why, but...
There might be a button or
double
something.
Double-check your microphone, that it's on the right microphone. I'm just going to do this real quick.
All right. Well, he checks that. Yep. Nate, you're off screen. You're good. See if you can get it figured out.
Yep. Once I start seeing audio, I will...
Hit refresh, and it might ask you to use... to allow your microphone or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. Anyway. We're going to have Nate on in just a moment, as we were just alluding to. Nate... a couple weeks ago.
I see some audio coming from
there. All right, we'll welcome him back then.
All right, Nate, say something once real quick. not a lot of audio coming out of that. Not a lot of audio. Go ahead and say it. I'm seeing... Natalie didn't have a problem, Nate. I'm just saying. Natalie didn't have a problem.
Oh, wait,
I heard a click. There you go.
There it is.
You guys, sorry.
Now you're good.
Yeah, power.
I guess you have to plug the... thing in all the way, so
all right.
That gets me all the time. I took down the whole DGBT one time like that.
All right, so again, officially welcoming in Nate Heinold. Nate, I was just gonna say, a couple weeks ago hosted the Junior and Masters Worlds in the Peoria area. This weekend, you and a sizable staff and crew joined the other staff and crew that was already in Michigan, but you brought more people from Peoria to host the 40th annual Discraft Great Lakes Open, presented by Grip 6. And then, in like, what, a week and a half, it's Ledgestone time? How you doing?
I am awake, but I literally fell asleep on my computer last night at 2:30. I finished bells and reviewing the reports for the event, and then we are on to the next one.
I feel like the D-Glow event, because of course we're on the Disc Golf Pro Tour side, we're featuring the MPO, the FPO divisions. That's where the spotlight is. That's what we do. But there was also an event with over 800 amateurs being played at three or four or five other courses.
Yeah, I mean it's DGLA will be the third largest event of the year in terms of competitors. The second largest will be Junior Master Worlds, and then the largest will be Ledgestone. So we had 831 amateurs at five courses. And so that kind of got lost in the shuffle because Toboggan takes a lot of the oxygen. But yeah, we had a lot going on.
Yeah, literally lots of oxygen out there while you're on the hillsides. You took this over this year, right? This was the first time.
Last year.
Last year.
Even I know.
Why is a tournament director from Peoria area taking over an Elite Series event in just outside of Detroit, Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Discraft, that's been their event for now four decades. And, you know, I work closely with them. But I mean, the bottom line is I think that our team does a phenomenal job. And I honestly thought we could do an amazing job. And so really, I think I've built kind of this engine that runs events. And I think we have, I would say, a competitive advantage with scale, especially, and other things like that, that allows us to not lose money by running these large events.
And we'll compare and contrast that slightly to most events are hosted by usually one or two people in charge, and then maybe a large or small army of club members and volunteers. And I feel like you've created a mix of having local but also paid staff, right? And that's kind of been your recipe for a few years now, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I have, I think, 20 people on my payroll now, my direct payroll, and then we use a lot of paid staffers for the events that are not just from Peoria, to be honest. I mean, I've got KO from Missouri and Jason from Indiana, and I got people from Wisconsin and, you know, Michael from Mississippi. And, you know, I have a lot of people that come from other states. And so I've created a nice little team, and I certainly couldn't do it without them. But I think that is the model. The model of a club running a big event, it's just not possible to do it the right way, because it takes so much time and you can't do it for free.
Yeah. And I guess some would say, you know, as a guy myself who's run 300-ish tournaments throughout the last few decades, the model today is very different from the model from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. What did you see in the previous models, and then how did you adapt and push them forward to where you are now?
I think the previous model, you know, you had these clubs or this small circle that cycled in every 2 or 3 years. So, you know, the first big Ledgestone I ran, 2015, let's be honest, it didn't go that well. And so we learned from those mistakes, made it better in 2016, but it still, you know, wasn't great. And so I think by the time those club people cycle out, they've learned everything. And now they're gone, and they got burnt out because they were doing it as a volunteer and storing stuff in their garage. And so that model is still employed some places, but it just doesn't work, because even if you run a PDJ major one time, you learn so much by doing that, but then you're done. And you may not do it again ever, or you may get so frustrated by complaints or bickering or whatever that you don't want to do it again. But when you run it a second time or a third time, I mean, it really becomes, I wouldn't say easy, but when we ran pro, you know, Master or Junior Worlds here just a few weeks ago, I mean, it was 1,100 players, but I wouldn't say it was easy, but it was a lot easier because of the events we've ran the last 5 years.
And when you're talking about that scale, you're talking about that many people, especially in that case, you're talking about two very different demographics. You're talking about everybody under the age of 19 and then everybody over the age of 40, and just very different everything, right? Naturally, there's going to be not only hiccups, but then there's probably going to be some legitimate concerns or complaints, I'm guessing. Some maybe are more trite or lighter than others, but some are probably very legitimate. What does your list of notes look like, and how do you constantly try and improve on those?
And what do you use to keep these notes on? Yeah. Like, is this like in your iPhone notes, or do you have a separate app? I need to know these things.
Yeah, is this in a spreadsheet database? What do we got?
I mean, if I could share my screen, it'd be fun. But the notes are massive, Johnny and Terry. We basically take feedback and we pull it together, and then I take it one step further and we do a survey. And this year we had 49% of the master and junior players respond. Which is off the charts. That's half of the people took 5 or 6 minutes to respond to a survey, and somehow 18% of our members can take 10 seconds to vote. And so anyways, I did do some giveaways. I gave away some discs, but still, I mean, I guess the PDJ needs to up the ante and start, you know, enticing people, but I'm just kidding. But we have a pretty big list of things that we can improve on every year, and we work on those things. You know, when we ran D-Glow last year, the big thing that came back to us was, you know, why didn't you paint the circles for the AMs? So we did that this year. Hey, you know, why didn't you have water on every fourth hole for the AMs? Wow. That's a lot, but yeah, okay, we'll do that. And so, and this year at Master Junior Worlds, the biggest complaint, which was didn't the pros get a player pack? And it was like so bad that it was some of the feedback was, best event ever, but the worst event ever, because we traveled here as a pro and didn't get a player pack. And I thought, huh,
that's different.
You know, the added cash was $50,000, but they're saying they're not playing for that reason. They can't cash. They're there to, for the perspective of a professional, but that's their perspective. And so they're not wrong and I'm not wrong. And so if we ran the event again, we'd try to do a small player pack for them. So
That's interesting feedback. And maybe that's been just a staple of Worlds. Even when Johnny and I played in 10 or 15 Worlds, you did get a player's pack.
I think, as you know, if I were to go play MP40, I would like a single disc with the event stamp. Like, cool. Just to prove I was there or something like that. Something, you know, because you can always buy them. But as a player's pack, I think it would be kind of nice to have. I can understand that. I don't know if I would complain about it if I didn't get it. But I understand, like, oh, it's kind of nice to get an event
stamp.
Some memento of sorts.
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, it looks like your internet is...
He must be in his... his
There you go.
Your internet's a little shoddy there sometimes, Nate.
There you go.
I've dealt with Terry, I think, in that same office, and yeah.
Okay, so
just to correct Johnny, not to correct Johnny, we had the feedback during the event, and then the last evening we sent the players an email saying, "Show up to the pro shop and get the swag item that you so desire." Yeah. So
nice.
So we tried to take immediate feedback. So that's live and learn.
Yeah, exactly. I would be, as a player, I would be like, cool, that's awesome. Thanks for listening. Honestly.
Yeah. So D-Glo's in the books. Any quick takeaways from D-Glo? I mean, we quickly recap the MPO action just a moment ago. Of course, we just talked to Natalie, but any cliff notes or major takeaways from D-Glo?
Yeah, I mean, from the inside, it was just an honor. I mean, that we had so many, you know, you talk about European Open spectators, but I would say that Sunday was probably the largest U.S. audience that's ever witnessed disc golf in person ever. I would say it rivals the 2014 Pro Worlds and even 2015 Ledgestone, when we kind of, that was, you know, the first time that got big, and we had $65,000 of added cash when the biggest yet had been 10 to 15. People were so curious what this Lake Eureka was about. I mean, that was, we had about 2,500 that day, but I think Sunday we had about 2,700 paying spectators. And then we had kids, and, you know, that for me was the biggest takeaway, was disc golf is here to stay. And in fact, it is growing.
Yeah, and the toboggan has become now this icon and is historic. And I guess, is there, you know, anything that you learned when looking at, you know, the three new holes that were put into play and just the overall feedback on the event, how, you know, you guys added cement tee pads out there a couple of years ago. Will that continue to evolve that course in any way, or is it kind of set now? Is it going to play like that for a couple of years?
Bob already has asked me twice for the stats. I ran the regression analysis tonight, actually. And so, we have four or five things we'll look at for next year, with some holes that, you know, maybe either played with, you know, too little scoring separation, or maybe played too easy or too hard. I don't think the course needs to be any longer personally. But I do think that we may need some more scoring separation on a few holes that played maybe with too many pars. So that's what we'll focus on most, is how can we make sure there's scoring separation?
I love that, and it's funny because I read a comment today condemning you, particularly Nate, saying, Nate Heinel just can't leave a course alone. Every year it's got to be something different, and we get a new course record because the course is different. And all I keep thinking is, yeah, they keep tweaking it to make it better. Like, yeah. Isn't that what we want? Don't we want the optimal, the best course? So I did get a kick out of that, which is funny because I just heard your interview, I think, on Ultra World, saying more or less that, like, the Eureka course is set. That's what it is. It's not changing, but Northwood maybe adjusts, you know?
Yeah, we haven't changed Eureka in like 5 years, and maybe I moved to pin back on 14 like 3 years ago, but then Northwood, you know, we just cleaned up the rough and then made two par fives probably a half stroke easier, but
Bring back the volleyball hole. Bring back the volleyball court hole, please.
Jeez. Okay. Don't go there. I have nightmares.
Pre-COVID. People don't understand that but us.
Yeah, this is why I leave him at home, Nate. So let's speak then a little bit before we get into Ledgestone. Let's get into Ledgestone. Ledgestone, essentially a week away. Really less than that if you start thinking about the extracurriculars. Of course, we have the Mid-America taking place on the Silver Series this weekend. A ton of our players have already found themselves over there. They're competing. And then they come to Ledgestone. You anticipate people arriving to town Saturday, Sunday, Monday? What do you anticipate? And talk about some of the numbers from both pros and AMs.
Yeah, I mean, we already have pros here. I mean, I've already had Brittany and Chris Dickerson bothering me in my office today, so with their dog. So if you're listening, Brittany. But no, I mean, we already have people here. We have people from other countries already here. I mean, we have the activity starting Saturday. I left D-Glo 40 minutes after Calvin putted out and drove straight home and made a wrong turn after I talked to you, Terry, drove towards you on accident for a half hour. So got home about 2 o'clock, but I had staff arrive yesterday for Ledgestone and they needed direction. And so my main core staff got back late, you know, last night. And then we have our biggest drop of the year on Thursday, actually, as well, with 40,000 discs dropping.
On my birthday? Oh, that's so sweet. I can't wait to get that coupon code.
Oh, I thought you were going to get
a $500 gift certificate.
Wait, show that
for my
again
birthday.
Once. Show that again once.
Well, that was the Paige Pierce one. This is the Paul Macbeth one. Those are gorgeous. So.
I'm sure Terry has told you we are not above being bought. So if like some of those happen to fall into the studio, I wouldn't complain.
No, Terry has made very clear that for the right price, this can be the Ledgestone propaganda show. So,
oh yes, that price is small.
You've already
too.
Made a down payment. That's been very clear to our guest here. Tons of drops, tons of things. Flex starts, ice cream socials, other charitable things going on. Kind of give a quick overview. And
yeah.
And do you have an app yet? Come on, do we have an app for all this stuff yet?
Wow, yes, I do. It's called the Ledgestone app, so you can go to the app store and download Ledgestone, but you have to get the password from us,
okay,
because you have to be a member, a player, one of the 2,200 players, by the way, or one of the 600 VIPs. We have 11 flex C tiers, 2 ice cream events, 2 food events, which is complicated for 2,000 people. We have dunk tanks and glow events and charitable contributions to St. Jude and the Paul Macbeth Foundation, all kinds of stuff. So really, I mean, it's really an experience. It's not just an event. We obviously have the pros competing for $150,000 purse, but we also have a lot of activities going on. It's a huge economic engine to the community, to be honest. So hotels have been booked for months. There's not an Airbnb available for 30 miles, you know, so it really is overwhelming, to say the least. I mean, I really don't sleep for 12 days, and that's how it goes.
Yeah, it's become quite the monster. I mean, if we're really just putting it out there, and of course there's some draws and similarities that we find with some of our other really large scale events. Of course, you just hosted D-Glo, which featured some of those things. Some who maybe haven't been there would liken it to what they've heard or experienced at a dynamic disc open with, you know, lots of C tiers and flex starts, extracurriculars galore. And like you just said, disc dying classes and vending opportunities. It's the largest scale event of the year. Is there anything else you can compare it to in terms of energy and effort? I mean, even outside of disc golf, I don't know what that would be, but is it like the equivalent of a marathon, I guess, maybe is what I would say.
I mean, I would say it's the equivalent of a large music festival that just can, you know, that has the main event, right? That's the pros playing And then it has all of these little side stages where you can, you know, go get your disc dyed, or you can dunk Jeremy Culling in a dunk tank, or get a signing from Paul Macbeth and wait an hour, or, you know, wait in line for 8 hours, or, you know, Ben Askren's going to be there and you can ask him to, you know, punch you in the face, so, or whatever. Right. So, I'm just kidding. So but,
that's a new feature.
I bet you, if you asked him, do you think you could sell tickets to knee him in the head?
I don't think so.
Wow.
Ouch. Ouch. Jeez.
I won't see him for like another year, so I'm cool. He'll
I think you're uninvited. Yeah, it's clearly this incredible task. And then maybe the last question on is, when it's all said and done, and we talked about the model a little bit, what are your staff and volunteer numbers look like when just to give somebody else a scope of what we're talking about?
82 staff members, I think. And then 225 volunteers. And then thousands of hours throughout the year on coursework. Like right now we're not, I mean, it rained 2.5 inches today. Our courses were looking pretty good. Not the right time to have 2.5 inches of rain, because it grows up all of that stuff I don't want to have grow up. So, but we'll be out there with our heavy machinery getting stuff ready the rest of the week. And, you know, that's part of the task. But I mean, it's really a full-time job, to be honest. I work full-time in disc golf is the bottom line.
Yeah, I would think, and I mean, I'm just throwing out ideas. That's what I am, and I'm an idea man. I don't do a lot, but I don't know. Some inflatable rafts might be in the player packs. You know, some people could just do some floating down the rivers or hanging out in your fairways that are all, it sounds like there's going to be plenty of water and rain out there. Ooh. Are we selling? That's what I'm doing. I'm selling spots for spectating out at Lake Eureka. I have another actual bright idea that I'll share with you offline about D-Glo. But anyway, all right, so enough about you and the hard work you do. It genuinely is appreciated, and I know our pro players have, you know, this week-long extravaganza to look to. Our amateur players do as well, along with the vending and everything else. You wear another hat in terms of being on the board of directors, and as it's been beat into largely our member base over this last month, is voting has taken place up until 11:59 Eastern time, Sunday night. And about, I don't know, 30 hours ago, we saw the election results. Talk to us about, truly from an inside perspective, like, talk to us about that process in terms of, you know, a third party, who they're reporting to, who looks at it, who assembles what, who shares it with the world. Kind of just break down that process.
Yeah, I mean, the PDJ uses a third party company. None of the board or, you know, has access to the data whatsoever. None of the staff have access to the data. I won't say the name of the company, but I mean, it is a third party election company. I won't.
I'm just saying, there was internet voting, and I just had to ask if they were involved.
You almost killed
me. Or Chavez. I don't know. Anyway, okay, go on.
Wow.
Maybe not. Maybe you guys use someone else this year. I don't know where you buy your pillows. Okay, go on.
Wow, yeah. Wow, I don't even know where to go.
That's all on me, folks.
Terry, sometimes I feel like I derail the conversation. Terry just threw that one off the tracks. Let's start.
All right, reset.
Phew. Start over.
We'll okay, how does that happen?
The companies don't get their pillows made in Giza. I think the Giza pillows. So anyway, we pay a company, outside company. The results come in and they get validated and. Right now, anybody can run for the board. So the current process doesn't even require you to be a member for more than one day. I mean, you can run for the board and put your resume in, and it's member's choice. So, you know, my response to the results was disappointing at the turnout. As I said, I sent out a survey that was 20 questions long for the world's competitors, and we had 49% response rate. So to only see 18% of our members vote after four or five emails is honestly shocking for, You know, I mean, the last few days I've averaged 50 emails a day on a various topic, you know, and so for our members to be outspoken about certain things and then not vote, just honestly, it just makes me frustrated. But, you know, that is what it is.
Yeah. And I know I danced around this last week a little bit just in, and I do feel like it's a valid question. And I feel like there's some comparison that needs to be had. I wonder who we all but eliminate in terms of an expectation from our voting. You know, and last week I know we said, you know, our junior player base is 6,700 deep. And I'm not suggesting a 17-year-old can't read and make an informed voting decision. But conversely, the 4-year-old that's never played in a tournament but got signed up for the PDGA and renewed from their parent, I don't expect a 4-year-old to necessarily be casting a vote either. And then you think about tournament directors, husbands or wives that, you know, are just really a member because they host an event. And then you think about, somebody said it perfectly today. They're like, hey, if your ratings keep coming out and nothing's going crazy, maybe the membership just says, eh, everything's fine. I don't really care who's running the ship. It'll just keep running. And there's some people that for that reason dismiss voting. I mean, I would love to see a greater turnout as well.
But like,
I don't know what a good number looks like.
I don't know what a good number looks like, but I think a lot of people join the PDGA because they like to play tournaments and they don't want to pay the $10. And that's
and they may not care about
the leadership because honestly to them it barely affects them. They're going to play their local events, they're going to play their local tour 5, 6, 8, 10 times a year, and they don't need to worry about that because things will just happen. Maybe they don't care about the pro game, maybe they don't care about, you know, in general the little bitty rule changes that happen. They look at it and they go, "Oh, okay."
Yeah,
I think that's 75% of our members. They could care less. I mean, so Johnny, you hit it on the head. Our research shows that our members care about one thing, and that's playing sanctioned competition and getting a rating, and that's about it. So yeah. You know,
which is fine.
Like you and I, which is great. So,
you know, I guess you know, again, I have a personal bias here in that I have daughters that are 11 and 13. They probably won't play a sanctioned event this year. And I just sign them up every year because I like the idea of them, or me in this case, supporting the PDGA, and they won't play a single event. And so I'm not necessarily expecting them to cast a well-informed vote because they just simply, they don't know and don't care. So that's why I sell their votes every year. So next year, I'm just kidding. No. So clearly a conversation that was, I hate to call it a single issue voting, you know, scenario this year, but a very, very, very topical conversation is our transgender athletes that are competing right now. Of course, we just had a very open conversation with Natalie a few moments ago, who fits into that category. And we also saw today both releases from the Disc Golf Pro Tour and from the PDGA. I read the emails, but can you summarize or explain what we saw in those emails today?
I mean, the bottom line is for a period of time, the IOC had said, hey, we're going to release guidance on this issue. We're going to release guidance. And that came this last February, and they essentially punted the decision kind of shockingly and said, our hands are clean. We're not doing anything about this. It's up to the various sporting organizations. So organizations like the PDGA had been kind of waiting to say, we're going to follow IOC policy, which we've been doing. I voted for the current policy that we have in place back in 2018-19 that follows IOC policy. So that was kind of a shocker for them to say, we don't have an opinion. So good luck, basically. And so that's my assessment of it. And so we very quickly set up a medical subcommittee that's looking very hard at this issue. And I hope to have their report. And I know they're working hard at it, but I hope to have that report in the next, you know, this year. I would say I hope it's sooner than that, but so we can give our members some clarity on where we're going to be going for the 2023 season. And that may be nothing. I mean, there may be no change. I mean, there may be, you know, anywhere in between. So I've seen people say a lot of things. So,
and just to be clear or clarify for everyone out there, you know, a few months ago, the PDGA essentially, as you're just alluding to, came out and said, hey, we no longer have specific guidance from the IOC. We've been using them. We're now going to create our own subcommittee that's going to pull in a number of people, a lot of professionals, researchers, doctors, all these different people. We're going to pull them in, research it, heavily look at it, and then submit a report and the findings back to the board level. So this is a subcommittee that's going to then submit back to the board level. And essentially what they did today is, in my opinion, is they said, hey, guys, just so you know, we're doing all that stuff and we're still doing it. And so just hang tight. Nothing's going to change before 2023, no matter what we do or don't find. Nothing's going to change, but we hope to have a report to come back to you with. Is that another way to word everything you just said?
Yeah, I think the reason for reiterating that stance is honestly, I mean, we could say it once a month and people would still say, what is the PDJ doing about XYZ issue, right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the reason for reiterating that, because yes, we're looking at it. The committee has very qualified professionals. Every single member outside of one on that committee has an MD in the field that matters here. And then we have one more MD who doesn't, but is considered an expert in the sport of disc golf. So we have people who are very knowledgeable looking at this very closely. And, ultimately at the end of the day, it's the board's decision. And so the committee is obviously advisory, but the board obviously will take whatever they say into, you know, obviously that will be very important.
Well, and I think that becomes another interesting point, and maybe why the Board of Elections results and or just the board in general is so crucial, because then I guess I would ask you, we just talked about assembling this very, very qualified, very insightful, researched, brilliant group. Is it fair to say that whatever they come up with as a recommendation, that feels like it should be all but a rubber stamp for the board to just follow that recommendation, right? That's the whole point of a subcommittee, or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everybody has personal biases. I mean, I can tell you now that no matter what the committee says, there's probably a board member that would vote this way. And no matter what the committee says, there's going to be a specific board member who I know would vote in the we're keeping things status quo, obviously. And so,
sure.
So, you know, I am somebody who is very interested in not just the scientific data, but I'm honestly as interested in hearing from specifically the FPO competitors. So, you know, if we have scientific data that maybe is, you know, which in my opinion, we're not going to get a definitive answer because there's not enough data. We don't have enough competitors that we're able to study over a period of years to even determine this, in my opinion. So I'm sure the committee can still give us something, hopefully, but I'm more interested in hearing as well, you know, what do our competitors think? If it's something where it's 50-50, then I think that would be tough to probably, you know, look at. But I think I'm very interested to hear what our competitors have to say about this.
And
I think, division, not the male competitors. So
I think it's interesting because a lot of people are speaking like that, saying, I really want to know what the FPO field feels. And I agree that that is important. But I also feel like this is a decision that will affect the entire sport of disc golf. Like, we saw what it did with swimming, national news. This, you know, depending on which way we go, and I don't obviously have an idea, it could affect sponsorship. You could look at someone like we'll just throw out the guarantee mortgage, guarantee rate, whoever the big sponsor was last year for the Pro Tour finale. If they look at whatever the decision is and they don't agree with it, they could pull their money. It's like, cool, thanks, we're not interested now. This is a decision that not only affects the FPO, because if you look at the FPO and you weigh it like this, you say, hey, if you vote this way, we get X amount of much money. If you vote this way, we are only going to get this amount of money. Or, and we don't know what that is. There's no way to know that in the future, because until the decision is made, we can't say. But I think this is bigger than just the FPL field, but it involves the entire sport.
And that's a relevant point, but we don't want to get to the situation where we don't listen to our players and then live golf, and then live golf happens, right? And we don't listen to the FPL players if they even feel the way that some people feel they feel. Then live golf happens, and some group comes in, and all of a sudden the PGA Tour is now fractured by this outside organization. And so, because maybe they didn't listen to their players and they weren't paying them enough or whatever it is. And in this case, that's why I want to hear from the players, because, you know, if it's split or whatever it is, I think that's very relevant, but I still would love to see as much scientific data as there is, you know, available to us.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and clearly Johnny nor I, who hold no official positions in any capacity, nor have any influence, have to sit back and at this point react to what is presented and unfolded and the decisions that are made. But I think one of the biggest takeaways for me, and you know, I reiterated this with Natalie, and I just think in general, is I personally, and I know I'm going to get hate for it, I personally do not believe the entire subject is as black and white as so many think that it is. And you can take that however you want, but to me, there is a lot of gray in a lot of the area, and I feel like even maybe Natalie would agree with that, and I don't want to speak for her, but I just in general, it's to me, it's not black and white like so many claim, and it's very sensitive and it's new. I mean, let's be real here for all of us. There's a lot of sports that are making a lot of different semi-similar or semi-different decisions about how they're moving forward. And obviously swimming is the most recent, but there's a lot of other sports that are continuing to look at their policies and where do we fall in line and where does our research go? I don't know. I mean,
I would say it's disingenuous for anybody in disc golf, Natalie or somebody on the other side that would say she has a major advantage, it's disingenuous for them to say it with confidence that there is or isn't an advantage. I would tell both of them, you're wrong. We don't have any definitive scientific study, even swimming when they came out and made this decision that you have to transition by.
I think you're saying by puberty.
Yeah, I think you hung up on us for a second, Nate. Hopefully you come back here.
Yeah, it's going to glitch out here for a second. I like to kind of do this.
All right, Nate, you were saying you said transition by...
Yeah, I said, you know, swimming, when they changed their policy and you had to transition, I think, by the age of 12, you know, they said there was some data behind that and that drove their decision-making, but you know, they didn't release that data. I mean, as the PDJ, we would love to see the data that they're using. And I mean, they're not releasing it and other organizations are keeping it tight to the chest, which means, you know, whatever that means. So,
yeah,
well, correct.
I was going to say, I don't envy any of it, but it's clearly something that we're all working through as both a Frisbee family, but also as competitors, but also hopefully as compassionate humans and understanding that these are all newer territories that we're wading through as a relatively young sport. I mean, you think about so many other sports that are out there, and then you think about disc golf's only 45 years old, and having these conversations have really only been brought into the spotlight in the last few years. It's all very heavy and very delicate to work through. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I would say one more thing that I think is very relevant. The people that want to, you know, limit participation for transgender athletes in the FPO division, some of the vile things they say not only are vile, but it hurts their credibility immensely and honestly makes it less likely that you would see, you know, any sympathy towards them, and it could influence the decision the other way. And so seeing hateful comments honestly makes people say, man, you know what? I mean, I want to have sympathy and empathy, no matter if I feel this way or that way. And so seeing some of the vile emails that I get, which are, you know, Nate Heinold, you're disgusting because you allow blah, 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 blah to compete. And it's like, wow. I mean, that's like, to me, I don't understand that at all. That's well, not going to help. If they want to make change, that's not going to help their position. So,
I mean, it comes to me, that continues to go back to my other large talking point was, let's discuss policy. Let's have adult conversations. Let's look at researchers. Let's look at, you know, professionals that are dealing this. And then let's have conversations that surround policy. Let's not bully the person or the people that are currently following the rules. That's my take on it. And that even will get blasted as well. And that's fine. But that's my takeaway.
And that's a good take at the same time with what I just said, that we should be, you know, Natalie is following the rules. So is any transgender. They're following the rules that have been set out by the governing body of the sport. And the people attacking her, you know, in those ways, they're 100% wrong. At the same time, it is not automatically transphobic or wrong for someone to say that this person may have a competitive advantage. To me, that is not wrong to have that debate. I think both sides need to come off of these positions of, if you say that somebody could have an advantage, that does not mean you're transphobic. On the same side, saying vile things is disgusting, and that is not going to help your case at all. In fact, it means that you should be deleted off of the chat, as Johnny's been doing.
Well, I mean, it's we're not here.
All the mods tonight have been helping out quite a bit.
And I guess to that point, I think that's, you know, maybe you could speak to it, or maybe we could blather on about it, but we've seen this earlier. The Disc Golf Pro Tour specifically, and I believe the PDGA, followed a very similar protocol of when things are posted to social media accounts, including sometimes YouTube or Facebook or wherever, you can have conversations, but not in an antagonizing and in a bullying fashion. And we know, as per even a few people on our chat tonight, that they don't make a distinction, and you just want to throw out free speech, and with free speech you think you can say whatever you want. Unfortunately, that's just not the case, and someone who's hosting on that platform, whether it's the PDGA or the Pro Tour, does not have to put up with you being a bully. And I think just people can't wrap their head around that. And I
hope all those people that are yelling free speech, I hope they let their 8 and 10 year old kids talk to them any way they want.
Yeah.
Free speech, mom. Yeah. I'd have 4 knuckles across my cheek if that happened.
At any rate. So, clearly, big moments, and as you have no idea at this point, and even if you did, I know you couldn't share it, but right now, the subcommittee is working on it. They're going to report back, and then we go from there. That's where we're at. So if you're at home right now calling for an immediate change tomorrow or next week, it's not happening. And if you're saying, well, in a month, things are going to be different and we're going to go retroactively take away a title from Natalie Ryan, that's not happening. They have made it very clear from months ago that things are being looked at now. And at earliest, 2023 is if or when we would see any change. And I just can't state that more clearly to everybody. So,
yeah, and I would say my goal will be to be as transparent as possible. If there is a change or if there's not a change, I will want to try to give as much information as we can and why that decision was made. I'm sure that the lawyers may tell me otherwise, but I would love for our members to be able to know, because this is going to be, if it comes to the vote and we have to make a decision, it's not going to be fun. I don't want to have to be in that position to look at the data and potentially, you know, go one way or the other, but that's the job. And so I will want to try to get as much out there as we can, but yes, the timeline you stated is correct, and I obviously hope that we have, you know, information sooner than later. But I also don't want the committee to rush the job. So,
well, as I've said before, I'll let those professionals do their job, do their work, and I'll be excited to see what the findings are when they come back with them, because I'm not about to interject anything where I'm going to actually be useful or insightful to them.
The only, I don't want to say problem is the wrong word, the only issue that I see happening is if the PDGA addresses it and we don't see it and we don't see a change, we're never going to hear the end of it. That's just the way it's going to be, because as long as it happens, it's not going to matter to some people, which is unfortunate. And we'll be able to point at the rules for the rest of our lives, just like we do this year. And I think that you're still going to get people that are going to scream PDGA needs to change the rules even after they make a decision.
Yeah. No,
so,
yeah.
I mean, and that's fine. I'm still mad at the PDGA for changing the master's age from 35 to 40.
Yeah.
And that was done in
15 years, 18 years ago, 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Nate, I think because you are here, this is and we are, you know, largely talking policy. A lot of people will naturally go to, you know, a conversation that we had just a week or two ago with one of our elite level players getting disqualified. And I don't want to go to that specifically at all. What I want to go to, though, is the policy surrounding how that gets dealt with on a very generic level. I'm not even concerned about him. I'm concerned about what does the disciplinary policy and procedure look like. I think this is a great opportunity for us to share with the world, because again, a lot of people have it twisted as to what they think should happen. How does the entire process unfold?
Yeah, who are you talking about? So I'm going to pull a Terry there. So I'm just kidding. Yeah, so,
see if I'm on the list. I should be suspended, probably.
You stole a disc, I heard.
Yes. Yeah. I was stealing discs on hole three this weekend. That's what I was doing, right?
Yeah. Don't you know that was my ESP force in the woods? No.
So probably. Nate, we need to talk about this because Terry was giving an unfair competitive advantage to Paige Pierce by helping her try to find her disc. Not every group gets that.
Not every group has a tear bear running around in the woods.
I'm just saying that we need to address this very soon before this gets out of hand.
Yes. Suspend me.
Yeah, so I'll be
don't make me walk that course again. Just suspend me
with the Smashbox disciplinary committee.
All right, let's talk about the process though.
To answer your question, you know, a TD or an official at a tournament has the ability to, or somebody affected by that incident has the ability to turn in a discipline complaint, which goes to a volunteer committee. That answers to the PDGA board and subsequently the PDGA board president. So the staff is not really involved. The committee looks at it. The chair of the committee is unknown to the public. It's listed on the PDGA site. We keep the rest of the members of that committee private for, you know, security reasons, to be honest, just if there's a suspension and we don't want members to be attacked online or, you know, in person, I suppose. But they look at it. They will immediately do a very short investigation of the report. And if they find it credible, they will vote to then look at the case or not look at the case. And so that's the process to even start the process. And then once they've agreed to look at the case, they will pull together the evidence with statements, potential video evidence, if it's available, which is rare to be honest, but statements from the accused, of any witnesses, the chair pulls all that together, sends it to the committee. They review that based on guidelines that we have posted, class A suspensions, class B, et cetera. You know, everything is in there from intimidation of an official to, you know, to cheating, to requesting a refund that you weren't entitled to and not giving the money back to the TD, which we've seen a bunch of those cases. They make their decision, and then it comes to the board president to confirm that they made the correct decision. The member then gets a letter that says they've been put on probation or suspended. And if they don't get suspended, then nothing comes of it. That member then has the right, I think 30 days, to appeal. If they appeal, it then goes to a few members of the board who review the case more in depth. So the board president, it really just confirms the decision that they followed the guidelines. Though the board president could determine that the punishment was too severe or not severe enough and make up his or her own decision. But the appeal then, you know, could be for any reason. The committee also could look at mitigating factors. Did the person apologize immediately? Did they show remorse? Those kind of things.
Okay. So just to be clear for the world, this is the policy. This is the procedure for any scenario. This is how things get played out. And I think there's a lot of people that feel as if there's you pick and choose in which this procedure unfolds, and you don't. This is how it always goes, you know, in taking the steps that you just described. And so I think that's worth sharing. Yeah. And of course, we've had a high profile player that may or may not be involved in that in some capacity. But I do think it's important because there's a lot of people wondering how does the process work and what will happen from here. And that's exactly where we're at. So.
And the process sometimes takes 2 to 4 weeks. And,
sure.
And so just sometimes people don't respond. And we give them 72 hours to respond. If they choose not to respond, that you know, it is used in their case, obviously. So if they choose not to, you know, give information, that's relevant. So.
And this is kind of a funny side note that, first of all, everyone that's on any form of probation or suspension is currently listed on a disciplinary chart that is accessible by anyone. It's out there on the PDGA website. It doesn't take much to find it. I came across it just the other day. And maybe this is of note, Nate. What's the number one reason that people are suspended or put on probation?
Cheating, unfortunately. So, and it's very easy to track nowadays because we have scoring apps and we can see if people are changing scores and maybe you changed it once and you had a reason and that makes sense. But if your group says you're cheating and they have a scorecard to prove it, and we can see in the scoring app that you changed your score 4 different times, but nobody else's score got changed, you know, we're going to present that data to you and you can choose to deny it. But you are not innocent until proven guilty. That is not the law doctrine that we have to follow. So, if there's enough evidence, and it's overwhelming enough, you are not automatically innocent in terms of discipline. This is not a court of law, you know, and so
sure. Or a private organization.
If they're very confident that you did this, they don't have to prove their case, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. So
I thought what you were going to say, honestly, is that and maybe it's because it's lessened throughout the years. It felt as if for many years, the number one reason people were suspended was a person runs a tournament and then fails to submit either the tournament results and or the money that's associated with running the tournament. It's not uncommon for somebody to host a B tier or a C tier. And at the end of the tournament, not only do they have to, you know, they used to have to do a lot more work, but they'd have to submit a few things to make the tournament official and then send in anywhere from $200 to $500, depending on what they collected. And we just found a lot of tournament directors, didn't budget correctly or got tripped up at some point or took that money to other nefarious places. I don't know. And next thing you know, you're given some grace period, but if you don't get it submitted, same thing. You ultimately go through a much this process of getting suspended. And it's an easy fix usually, but right?
Yeah.
So that's not the most common anymore.
Those cases don't even come to the committee anymore. There's too many of them from what I remember. And so those are handled by the office just because if you don't pay your fees, we give you time and then you are suspended until you pay them. So that's an automatic thing that the office handles now. That would be way too much work because that's a cut and dry thing. Hey, you owe $1,000. You haven't paid the fees. You know, that doesn't need to go for review. That is a black and white situation. So
sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, as you said, there's not a whole lot of subjectivity to that matter. It's, hey, you owe, you took too long, you still didn't pay. You got an extra chance or two, you still didn't pay. All right, now we're just suspending you. Yeah, and I do feel like that was very much a, unfortunately, is pretty common.
Somebody asks,
I said the other most common one is the whole, wow, I withdrew from this tournament 2 days before, and that TE decided to give me 50% of my money. Click, I'm going to do a PayPal dispute, and I'm going to get my money back. And guess what? That is actually a suspendable offense. So until you reimburse the TD, because if they choose to follow the PDJ refund policy, which they are entitled to, and I encourage them to do, which I just saw Terrabear post about a hole sponsorship issue, which I do the same thing. So, you know, if you sponsor a hole and you want to back out, we've already printed your sign. You're going to get that sponsorship. So, but that is the other most common thing is people who try to pull that stunt, basically.
Okay. Yeah. And if there's a way to circumvent the rules, unfortunately, somebody will. But the problem is with technology, timestamps, computers, and everything else that we've kind of referenced.
Yeah.
You can't be quite as sneaky or slimy today as you could 5 or 10 or 20 years ago.
With the newfound cash coming into disc golf, has the PDGA looked at monetary fines for issues that we see on the course, implementing any sort of, you know, oh, that's a $1,000 fine if you're caught cheating or something along those lines? Has there been any discussion about that?
We have not discussed that at this point in time, so no.
And I know it'd be very difficult.
I think that would only makes sense at the pro tour level, to be honest. So, and that'd be more of maybe a pro tour specific policy, you know, a DGPT specific policy, but
sure,
that's totally just, I've never heard of even the pro tour considering that, but that's not on the PDJ's radar at this moment. So,
okay. That makes a lot of sense.
only because I posted about it this weekend. Who has the conversation about the 30-second time violation? And this has nothing to do with Europe or any other player. This is a very, very generic conversation because I have often been frustrated. And what's becoming more popular, I feel like, is competitors are often exceeding 30 seconds because they're using a range finder or some aid of that nature. They're not really taking into consideration by the time they've grabbed their rangefinder, got their distance, put their rangefinder away, got their disc set up, gone through their routine, they're at a minute and 10 seconds or a minute and 20 or 210 or 55 seconds, whatever the number is. They're not doing it within 30 seconds. I love rangefinders. I'm not opposed to them. And even if I was, they're not going away because we'd find other GPS mechanisms probably. Is there any conversation about that? And if so, who has that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that using a rangefinder does not give you extra time. So I gave two players this week at DGLO time violations. So I have no problem putting a watch on somebody. If they're using a rangefinder, I love Bushnell and what they've done in the sport. And they're great for the sport of disc golf, but using a rangefinder does not extend your 30-second window. You have to, you know, that time of getting your distance is part of your 30 seconds. And so I have no problem making a call with that because I can't stand slow play. I don't like five-hour rounds. And so I get up and I chuck. As a player myself, that's what I do. I don't expect every player to not take that much focus, obviously, but I do expect them to follow the rules. And so that is a policy that would, you know, we have a rule book and we have a competition manual, and those kind of discussions would be had within the rule committee and the competition committee.
Okay. Okay. And I'm, again, that was a generic comment. It's becoming more common, and I'm not equating that to the person that's in the nastiest of rough off the fairway, and for the first time in the entire round, they arguably took 34 seconds. That is not what I do not equate that to the person that, as I described, uses a rangefinder in a wide open field. They do it every hole, every other shot, and everything is taking a minute and 9 seconds. To me, those are not the same conversation pieces, but nonetheless.
Hey, I don't only design courses that take 5 hours. I see that comment.
So, I know. I was going to say you don't like that, and now we're playing Northwoods. That's like
Northwood Black and Ledgestone, or not Ledgestone, Eureka. But Deglow and Eureka.
Yeah, take 8.5 hours at Northwood Black. They love that. We all love that.
It hurts.
Getting killed out here, folks.
Deglow, the last round for MPO was 3 hours and 10 minutes. Last year, MPO Eureka was 2 hours and 57 minutes. We won't go into the Northwood round time, but they are going to be better this year. So just mark my words.
We joke about
the last round at Eureka was canceled. Yeah, I don't think you can add that into your averages. That one took 0 minutes.
The last round that we played in full, Terry. Hey, you. I know you're gonna be here soon. I know what makes you tick. So just calm down.
All right, we'll see about that. Nate, do you have anything else to share with the world? I leave that as very open-ended. It could be Ledgestone, it could be PDGA, it could be insurance, it could be your sister's great cooking and baking. I don't care. Do you got anything to share?
What's insurance? I'm not sure. I don't know.
Do you still sell that? Give us the 10-second insurance plug here. I mean, we're here for
it. There's no insurance plug to give. The plug I will give, though, is that we are trying to raise a lot of money for charity this year again.
Okay.
And we have our largest drop of the year on Thursday night. You can go to our Instagram, click our link in our bio to get to the St. Jude website, where you can donate to St. Jude to get the chance to make a purchase early in that drop. But it's clear Malta, but we have wonderful discs that we're dropping. We have 30 different molds and Yuli molds, Macbeth, Page molds, all of the above, Zuka carts, range finders. So the purpose of that drop is to raise over $100,000 for St. Jude and the Paul Macbeth Foundation, and to support the efforts to continue to push the Ledgestone added cash and to the next .com is where you can show up to work next week, and I'll hook you up.
All right. I like it. We'll make sure everyone gets out there again. Yeah, you have. What's the total number in terms of charitable contributions in the last 6 or 8 years combined? St. Jude, Paul Macbeth Foundation, and others. You play. What are the totals?
I'm gonna look it up, but it's $382,000.
$382,000 wow. has been collected and then dispersed to various charities, largely being St. Jude has been your biggest recipient over throughout the years over there, St. Jude Children's Hospital. So it's so awesome to see those additional ties and community outreach locally and with what Macbeth does and worldwide. It is truly incredible. We cut out on him.
Yeah,
I'm guessing his mother chimed in. Nate, sweetie pie has to go night night here pretty soon. All right,
we'll cut that. Thanks a lot, Nate. He might jump, he might hop back in, but we're just gonna kind of call it for now. Much appreciated for all the input that Nate has given us in regards to TDing and PDGA policy. all basically anything you want to know, Nate has information on it.
Yeah. So make sure you check it out. I think
you can go right to the Ledgestone website. I believe.
Let me double check on my connection. Yeah, if you go to shopledgestone.com, it says the drop, August 4th.
The drop.
Okay. I'm pretty sure. I'm going to put the link in the YouTube chat there, but it is the drop on August 4th. Sounds like where I was last week in Illinois.
You were at the drop?
Six Flags Great America, but that's another story. All right. I think that is that's good on Nate's end. So Nate, we do appreciate it. Sorry, it sounds like you ran out of internets at Ledgestone over there, but certainly looking forward to it. And I'm gonna have a unique role personally, just say next week I am not scheduled to be part of the Disc Golf Pro Tour media team.
Thank goodness.
I will be out of your hair, Johnny. Whew. And I will be helping Nate and the event crew. I've had a long history. Well before he was on the Disc Golf Pro Tour, I was doing work with Nate and this event very back in the very, very early days of this event, as it spans more than 10 years. And so excited to be part of helping out. Last year, I even had a goofy role in that I was there for a couple days, did a few things, and then I had to leave for my half-sister's wedding. So I wasn't even there for the conclusion. But according to Calvin and Ricky, I didn't miss much on that final round. So
no. Old.
Yeesh. All right. So we'll have a definitive winner, hopefully, this year. All right. I think that's it for actual real business, as far as I can tell.
We got all the real business done, didn't we?
We certainly did. I think we got plenty of information out there. I also will have lots more to talk about. We'll chit-chat here in the after show. But I think in terms of the regular show, unless you have anything wild or crazy that we have to touch on, Johnny, you don't.
I don't.
Okay, either do I. We're going to call it. We're going to head into the after show. If you've been here before, I'm sorry. And if you're new here, well, when we head into the after show, we usually largely separate ourselves from the slightly more serious content that you find in the regular show. We could still get into some other topics. We read things off the message board. We always read the things off the super chat even faster if you're looking to put it in there in the message board. And some of our topics will be both disc golf and non-disc golf related. If you have something for us, put it into the chat and we can react accordingly. Or we might ignore it if it's ignorable.
YouTube chat, preferably.
Yes.
We do see the other chats, but you will not get to interact with other people because they will not see yours.
And there were at least postings of a lot of people saying that they had a tie or a vested interest in this evening's show. And a lot of them saying, even from an international perspective, and some people had said they set alarms so that they could partake in watching and listening to the conversations tonight. And if you did that, bless you. Hopefully we provided some insight and hopefully we touched on the subjects and had an enjoyable experience that was as adult and civil as we could bring for you. So we do appreciate anyone that would take that kind of dedication to set an alarm in another country just to get up and listen to what we had to say live.
And I'm going
to
be spending the next 2 to 4 days, as well as you will, hopefully, monitoring the comments on this podcast.
Yeah, and YouTube. And unfortunately,
not just the live chat, but the comments.
Yeah, and sometimes it's easier just to turn them off. And again, we don't need to go down that whole
free speech
censorship argument. But if you don't bully anybody, you don't get your comment deleted. That's kind of usually how it goes. So we appreciate you. You may not appreciate us, and that's fine too, but thanks for joining us. Thank you to Natalie Ryan, our champion at DGLO this last weekend. Congrats, of course, to Kelvin Heimberg and Corey Ellis, who put up the fight that he did. Congratulations to Kelvin, though. We just had him here in studio a few weeks ago, and I'm not saying it's a Smashbox bump, but he was here.
He literally spent the night.
Yeah.
And then went to Europe and came back.
But yeah, negating that 12th and 8th place finish. Don't worry about those. But Nate Heinold, also thank you for wearing the hat of tournament director as well as PDGA board president. We appreciate the additional insight we got from a PDGA's perspective. For Johnny V, I'm Terry Miller, the Disc Golf Guy. That's been Welcome to the 414 podcast of Smashbox TV. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with our after show. We'll see you then. You step inside the Smashbox.
Thank you to our $2 and above patrons. Your name is listed below in the credits. If you are interested in being listed as a producer in the Smashbox TV credits and supporting this and other fine podcasts, please visit patreon.com/smashboxtv.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.